Checko us out. It's time for another Flat Chat. And as the latest issue of GP Racing magazine hits the shelves, we congratulate ourselves on the serendipitous timing of putting Sergio Perez on the cover. And joining me, Stuart Codling, for this orgy of mutual backslapping are, as ever, Ben Anderson.
Hello, Codders. Well done to us.
Hooray. Well done, us. And Mark Gallagher.
Very nice to be with you. And yeah, Sergio Perez needs to thank you for that excellent timing. Did you you give him a bit of luck, Ben, with all of that, didn't you? You've made him famous.
It does seem that way. Let's claim all the credit for his Baku win. But of course, you know, previous month was Valtteri Bottas and his career's gone massively downhill since he appeared on our cover.
So let's not mention
it doesn't always work out for the best.
Well, yeah, as I said before we hit record, it is 13 years to the day, or on our recording date at least, that Robert Kubica took his only Grand Prix victory in Canada. And that happened after we'd gone, do you know, it's about time we put Robert Kubica on the cover. And in between us doing all that and the magazine coming out, he dutifully and obligingly won and made us look very clever. So here we are, 13 years later, another Formula One driver making us look clever. So a couple of weeks ago, Ben, you had an exclusive interview with Perez, and this is the result. And it's even more interesting to read it in the context of his win last weekend, because he talks pretty frankly about how he struggled to adapt to the car, but he was aware that that was the only way he was going to succeed, because the team weren't going to adapt the car to suit him. And he sort of said the memorable phrase, first get on the pace, then you talk. And he did that very effectively last weekend, because although he won because Max Verstappen retired, he fought to get into that position to benefit from that. So it was well done all ways round.
That was one of the standout quotes, I think, from the interview. And probably a refreshing change of pace for Red Bull, because, you know, we've been over this many times, but they've gone through a recent history of having young and experienced drivers in the car, but also in the case of Pierre Gasly, certainly a driver that wanted to try and get the car to work for him by changing the car, going through various different pedal setups and different settings and what have you, and in truth getting a bit lost. And Perez has gone there a bit more of a seasoned campaigner, with a refreshing attitude, which is, okay, I know the car's quick. I can see that there's, you know, a really, really fast driver in the other car winning races, getting pole positions. That's the target. It's my job to get close enough to that, that I'm doing the right job before we start talking about changing this, that and the other on the car. It's not absolutely that straightforward, but you can see he's taken that approach. He also said he would take five races to get up to speed, and then of course he gets to the sixth race and wins, and he looks like he's, you know, he looks like a soothsayer himself based on what he was saying at the start of the season. But there are other things that come into play there. When Perez was at Force India and Racing Point, they used to talk up how strong he was on so-called front-limited tracks, where the outside front tyre is a limiting factor with grip. It wears out fastest, and any driver who can look after that tends to do very well. China's another one of those circuits. And Andrew Green, the technical director of that team, said before the start of this season that, you know, Perez's driving style was quite extreme, one of the most extreme they'd seen. And of course he goes to Red Bull now, and you can see from the early races on the conventional circuits where Verstappen struggled against the Mercedes drivers, and he struggled at the rear of the car. You know, the rear tyres have been giving up, and that's given Hamilton his edge over Max. So the Red Bull is definitely a rear limited car, and you get the sense from what Perez has been saying and was saying in my interview with him, that he said that everything that he did at Force India just doesn't work in the Red Bull. So he's basically had to unlearn the techniques and the habits that he's built up actually over 7 years. He's had such stability at that team, and to try and work out a new way of driving. And it seems like that's paying off for him step by step. You know, he's had flashes actually throughout this season of real form. He's been fastest in the odd practice session. He's been fastest in the odd Q2 session. He's really struggled to string the weekend together. But at Baku, you saw him quick in every session. He was a contender for pole, and he was right there to take the victory when Max suffered his blowout. But I think that circuit suits Perez as well. So you probably had the perfect marriage of his natural driving style suiting the circuit to a T. He's always been really strong at that track ever since Formula One first visited Baku, and then also his process of gradually understanding and adjusting to the Red Bull, not trying to complicate things by changing the car too much, just trying to work out what it takes to drive it, chase the reference that he's got in Verstappen. And it's all paying off for him now. I mean, winning that race is going to take the pressure off massively as well. You know, that's that kind of big result just makes some of the question marks that have been legitimately asked of him go away. It's something that didn't happen for Alex Albon, of course. You know, he was very close to achieving a couple of big results when he got promoted, but he had a magnetic attraction to Lewis Hamilton in certain corners of certain tracks, and that just, when you lose those big results, the pressure just ramps up further and makes it harder then for you to believe in the process that you're going through. But not for Perez. Everything's come up trumps at the right time, so well done to him.
The change of the environment, going from, as you say, a team where he's been for 7 years into a team where everything is unfamiliar. You know, the people, the setup, the car, the cockpit, the steering wheel, the ergonomics, you know, you name it, every element. And the way that that's affected him. And he makes the point that you only have to look at some of the other talking points so far this season, whether it's Daniel Ricciardo or, Sebastian Vettel going to Aston Martin, you know, a few other examples, to see drivers taking time to acclimatise. And I think this is one of the points that is a factor of the lack of testing now in Formula One, because back in the day, when there was unlimited testing, by the time the season would have started, you'd have had thousands and thousands of kilometres of testing, and there wasn't kind of the learning on the job, which is now very much the case. And track time is really quite, you know, it's limited. It is no question in terms of flat out flying laps. It's quite limited. So he makes that point about the change of the environment. And I think it's a point well made, because we are all guilty of getting excited about new driver lineups and expecting great things, you know, on day one. And then when it doesn't happen, we start to criticize, you know, what's wrong with Ricciardo? What's wrong with, you know, why is, you know, what's happening with Sebastian Vettel? You know, Sergio, as you say, I mean, he's, you know, beautifully forecast. It would take him kind of five races to get in, and then he's gone and won that race. And I was talking to someone quite close to Red Bull recently who said, you know, everyone's got to understand, Sergio wasn't employed by Red Bull Racing to go and beat Max Verstappen. He was employed by Red Bull Racing to be in the supporting role and to deliver on a day when, you know, Max has a problem, or, you know, whether that's a technical problem, or, you know, whether he makes a mistake or whatever. And so Baku perfectly played to that strategy. He put himself in the position most likely to take the win if anything happened. And he doesn't need to do that every weekend. But Red Bull now, I mean, you could see the delight. I mean, it's a fabulous photograph I came across on Sunday night of Max and Helmut Marko congratulating Sergio. And you can see there's genuine happiness on everyone's face, because that's his job. He's been employed to deliver for the team. And when you look at it from a constructor's point of view, and specifically talk about the battle against Mercedes-Benz, Red Bull seem to be edging towards having a proper two-car lineup with two drivers able to deliver those performances at a time when Mercedes have got some issues with the car. There's been a weekend, at least one weekend, where, you know, maybe Lewis hasn't been on it. Valtteri, we don't need to say too much more. He's really struggling. And so the strength that Sergio has injected to Red Bull is very interesting. And I think another aspect of all of this shift and, you know, the decision from Helmut Marko to move away from putting yet another young Red Bull driver in alongside Max Verstappen, is that when they put Sergio in the car, there's a recognition of what experience brings. And it's just that know-how, that calmness that comes with, you know, as Sergio said, he says in your interview, you know, once you're in the groove with the team, once you know that car, you actually have 100% confidence that you can deliver most of the time. I think he says 100% of the time, you know, you can deliver 99% of the time. So it's a really interesting insight into his thinking, and very timely, because coming ahead of that weekend, it's like, you know, he's just nailed it. And, you know, he may not win another Grand Prix until Max has another difficult weekend or something goes wrong, but that's fine. If he just picks up the odd win, he's more than repaid the faith. And it also, I know, has come at a really timely moment for him in terms of his contract negotiations, because they're planning to talk to him over the course, I think, of June and July. So, you know, perfect timing for Sergio. And I'd be surprised to see them to change that for 2022.
Yeah, it's worked out really well for him. Vindicates the team's decision, vindicates his decision to take the risk, if you like, of going into, you know, what looked like a very difficult seat for anyone, you know, without the background with the team. I mean, he did say actually, also in the interview, that he was prepared to take a sabbatical this year, had the Red Bull thing not worked out. Let's not forget he was out of a drive. Lawrence Stroll had ditched him for Seb Vettel, so Perez, despite his history with that team, you know, and wanting to stay, had the contract and everything in place, he was out. But he seemed very relaxed. He said, I'm not going to name the teams, but I had options to come back, a really good option to come back in 22 regardless. So I'd have sat on the beach if the Red Bull thing hadn't come off. He also had some talks, we know, with teams with teams other than Red Bull to race this year. But he said, I was very clear in my mind that I wanted a chance to win. And of course, you know, we know that winning the world championship is not really a realistic goal while Red Bull is focused on Max Verstappen winning the world championship. But it was the best option he had in terms of going on to win more races. And, you know, he's done that now. So it's wins all round, really, I think, in terms of, you know, Perez easing himself into that team, the team feeling the confidence that he can get the job done. If that race had finished under normal circumstances, he was going to take points away from Lewis Hamilton while Max extended his lead in the world championship. So it was absolutely the perfect weekend from Perez's point of view and from Red Bull's, until obviously the tyre disaster happened.
The Sergio Perez story is such a good human interest story, isn't it? That career trajectory that he's had,
yeah,
you know, coming into Formula One, spending, you know, quite a long time as a nearly man, and going through some pretty, you know, extraordinary times at Force India, you know, company effectively hitting the walls, the key role that Sergio played in keeping the team going, you know, the roller coaster ride of all of that, then the Stroll takeover, then the, you know, to find out that he's out of a drive, then to take that victory, and now here he is 6 months later and he's taken his second victory and it's for Red Bull Racing. It is a great story, and I think in the sport where all too often we see drivers not able to fulfill their potential because they never do finally get that breakthrough. I mean, I'm thinking of someone in a similar vein like Nico Hülkenberg, you know, that, you know, it runs out of steam at the end of the day. But in Sergio's case, it hasn't. And I just think it's, you know, it's going to be great. I just really hope that we end up with Sergio, while he's still at Red Bull Racing, being able to go home and race in Mexico City. And I would love to see the reaction to that, because, I mean, they already were so behind him. I mean, the enthusiasm for Sergio at that race was always terrific. And it's been a shame that, you know, obviously the pandemic has had a big effect on these long-haul events. And I suspect racing at home does give him 0.2 seconds. It would be interesting to see that happen.
The Nigel Mansell of Mexico.
And Red Bull are good at Mexico. And, yeah, so, yeah, it's... It's just a great story, and but I mean, let's face it, that podium in Azerbaijan was just good stories. It was a great podium.
Oh, yeah, all the way through, Sebastian, wasn't it?
Just fantastic, yeah. You know, really, really.
Team Dadford did well.
Exactly, or Jordan Martin, as I was calling them, on Sunday. Yeah, Team Dadford, Team Silverstone, a great result. I mean, it's and again, it's taken Vettel a while. But as you saw the race unfold and you realise he'd done that long stint and he was on fresher tyres, and then the question was, could he really take the fight? Could he use the benefit of that extra grip and really go for it? Well, he seems to have got his mojo back from a racing perspective, a wheel-to-wheel racing perspective, and that was great to see. I mean, you wouldn't have put anything on Vettel getting second place after we saw the first couple of races of this season. And yes, we all know the weekend was slightly unusual. You know, Max effectively was robbed of the race by that tyre failure, tyre blowout, whatever it was.
Shall we get into the topic of Pirelli? Because obviously, being a bit of a bruising weekend for Formula One's sole tyre supplier, also present in the WRC, where a very suitably social viral thing occurred. Mads Osberg launched an expletive-laden tirade about the quality of Pirelli's tyres, the gravel tyre compound in that. And then, of course, everyone's saying, well, why did Pirelli bring a step softer tyres to the Azerbaijan, especially given that a one-stop race, more or less, would have eventuated. Also, more fiddling around with pressures during the course of the weekend. I'm saying this only because I'm advocating those arguments and putting them forward. We're about to shoot them down because, as we know, it's not the left rear tyre that's stressed in Baku. And changing the tyre pressures is pretty much par for the course as knowledge evolves over the weekend. But nevertheless, it's what people have said, so we should probably address that, shouldn't we, Ben?
Yeah, it's a conspiracy theorist feast, isn't it, what happened in Baku? Because
it's a smorgasbord of conspiration.
I'm not even sure what that is.
It's an all-you-can-eat idiots buffet of conspiracy theory.
Okay. Well, with apologies to idiots everywhere, I think as bad as it looked, and of course we've gotten so used to over the years seeing, you know, spectacular Pirelli tyre failures in Formula One, and, you know, some pretty farcical races, you know, particularly the 2013 British Grand Prix, where every leader seemed to be pictured with a flailing carcass of rubber hanging off the back of their car. Pirelli has an image problem when it comes to tyre failures and a technology problem historically. But in the case of Baku, the facts of what happened don't fit with the theory that, you know, this is just the same old shoddy Pirelli product that's let everybody down. Because as we discussed previously in the Perez segment, Baku's a front limited circuit, so if your tyre was wearing out to the point where it would break, it would be the front right that let go before any of the others. And you could see, actually, Lando Norris, he's the key defence for Pirelli, really, from that race, because he was the first to stop, I think after lap 7 or something ridiculous, and put the hard tyres on. And by the end, before the red flag, he was having radio conversations with McLaren, and he was saying, oh, the vibrations are terrible. And they were saying, yeah, it's the front right, be careful. So he was on the limit with the tyre that you would expect to go from a wear point of view. From a temperature point of view, which, you know, going softer is designed to help the teams generate temperature in the tyres. It's a smooth surface, it's a street circuit. There's not many high G, high downforce corners. So it's hard to generate tyre temperature. The softer you go on the compounds, usually if Pirelli have got the temperature ranges right, the better it is. Although Mercedes obviously are really struggling with that at the moment, as we can see. It's the rear right that would be of temperature concern in terms of it overheating. You know, that's the one that's getting most loaded up when you go through the mostly left-hand corners that permeate that circuit, and all the, you know, wheel spin you get from acceleration. And of course, in Verstappen's case, Red Bull were telling him, well, in the early part of the race, look after the rear right, because that's the one that will cause concern from a temperature point of view. He did that, and they were having no problems. They were seeing no spikes on the data. Obviously, the teams have so many sensors on these cars, they know really what's happening with the car and the tyres in real time. So for the rear left to be the one that failed both on Verstappen's car and Lance Stroll's car doesn't really fit with this idea that it's, you know, the most loaded tyres that are just giving way because they're not good enough. It's more likely, in this case, that those cars have run over something, an errant piece of debris, maybe a curb that's breaking up. You know, these cars are quite flimsy. They're designed to race fast, not to last. So they're forever shedding bits that you don't necessarily see on the TV screens. You pick up one of those.
We blame Colin Chapman for that.
Yeah, you happen to run over something at the wrong angle and you pay for it. It was also very windy in Baku. Charles Leclerc talked about having to dodge a piece of tree branch while he was racing Lewis Hamilton in the early stages. So there's obviously lots of detritus just hanging around the locale. And obviously a street circuit like that, lined with barriers and fairly narrow in most places, it's quite hard to clean the track when you do have incidents. You know, the marshals do their best, but you haven't got the natural topography of gravel traps and grass verges and what have you, where you can easily just sweep the rubbish away. So I get why Verstappen particularly is so frustrated, and I get why he's poured fuel on the fire and said, oh yeah, well, Pirelli will just say it's debris. They always say that, because he's suffered the worst. You know, he's had lost a nailed on victory to a really unfortunate piece of bad luck. Plus he had the incident at Imola last year where he lost a good result to another random tyre failure. But I'm not saying Pirelli have done a perfect job down the years. They got plenty to answer for in the past, but you do also just sometimes have very unlucky random tyre failures based on things you can't control. And I don't want to preempt the results of Pirelli's own analysis and the report that they'll issue before the French Grand Prix, because obviously it's a serious thing, and if there is something they've got fundamentally wrong with the tyre, they need to fix it pretty sharpish. But I just don't think that's what's happened in this case. I think it's just something you can't really legislate for. And if there was a problem with Pirelli's tyres, I think we'd have seen a different type of failure in the first instance, and we would have seen many more than the two we saw in Baku.
Having seen Stroll's accident, I think like everyone, truly shocked to see Max, not because he was leading the race, but because there was another failure. And there is a right-hand kink on that straight, so there would have been a little bit more load on the left rear at the time it went. I think it was pretty well just before the speed trap, wasn't it? So, you know, absolutely flat out. And, you know, we've seen this before in Formula One down the years. I mean, someone messaged me to say, oh, it's like Mansell and Adelaide, you know, this spectacle of a tarp exploding like that. But when I saw what happened to Max, I was genuinely concerned. Because, of course, when you see a tyre failure, whether it's due to debris, whether it's due to a tyre issue, you don't know until you do the investigation after the race. And while the race is still going on, and there are, whatever there are, 16, 17 other cars on the track still racing in the unknown with a potential failure like that is not clever. And how many failures do you have before you stop a race? And maybe it's because I'm getting older, but I genuinely was waiting to see the race being stopped within a lap of Max's failure. I thought, this is it. They're just going to stop the race. There'll be a count back. Max will take the victory. FIA will say, well, it's a prudent thing to do because we couldn't possibly understand what was going on. And particularly when Red Bull were so publicly, you know, on the radio straight away, said, you know, Jonathan Wheatley, I think, came straight on and said, you know, we had no warning. That went without any warning. Having said that, what then subsequently happened, so pause the race, red flag the race, do the restart, was quite a prudent procedure to go through. And as things turned out, it injected huge interest into the final laps of the race. But we've seen tyre failures down the years. Pirelli have had a patchy record. And they've had a patchy record against a backdrop of being asked to do a number of things during their provision of tyres. And some of the things they've been asked to do by the sport, you know, they're responding to what the sport is asking them to do, have not been easy. Fair play to Pirelli. They've stuck behind Formula One over the years, provided, you know, significant funding and support for the championship, whilst quite often getting a lot of criticism. You know, anything happens at all, they get a huge amount of criticism. So I'm with you. You know, we've got to hear what the results of the investigation are. I have a lot of sympathy for Max's comments about the fact that, well, you know, we know what's going to happen. They're going to just blame debris and say it's not our fault and all that kind of thing. I think I understand why Max is saying that. But actually, I think there's a little bit of truth insofar as when Pirelli do carry out these investigations and then you get the press statement, you know, the public statement, we've done this investigation, we're satisfied that there wasn't an issue with the tyre, there was clearly some debris picked up. It's a little bit too easy to say that. And I think for all the other stakeholders in the sport, I'm not talking about the teams, I'm talking about the media, corporate sponsors, you put so much money into these teams, that hundreds of millions of fans around the world. When you have a failure like that, it feels like Pirelli need to come to the table with something really quite compelling. And, you know, whether it's the media, whether it's the general public, plenty of smart people following this sport. We don't need to be fobbed off with a two-paragraph press release with a saying, you know, we've had an investigation, it's fine. If I was running Pirelli's, you know, corporate communications, I'd actually want there to be a comprehensive investigation and then to bring the data to the media and to the public and say, so here's the reality of what happened. And here is the evidence upon which we base our findings. Because actually, I think when they it's not that they gloss over it. They deal with it internally within Formula One. But I think externally, they shouldn't gloss over it or even be seen to gloss over it. They should come with something really quite compelling and say, here are the reasons why our tyres are really very, very good and why those failures were anomalies created by something else. And it's very likely to be debris. And I mean, even if they come and they, you know, have photograph, I mean, why not publish photographs of the tyre and say, as you can see, it destructed so comprehensively that it's impossible to tell if there was a piece of debris that, you know, there's nothing to you know, you can't see a clear cut or whatever. That's the kind of approach that I would think. I kind of feel that Pirelli become a passenger of the narrative around these issues, and they actually should really, really take the lead and have a little bit of faith in those of us who follow the sport so closely to you know, deliver those messages authentically. You know, just give us the information.
Show us your workings out, basically. It's like your maths homework, isn't it? You know, if you show the workings out and show how you reach the conclusions, you remove that sort of the fog of war and the uncertainty. Because when people can't actually see the detail, the data and whatever, the mind naturally invents something to fill that space and to explain it, because the human brain loves narrative. And this is where these conspiracy theories come out, because it's basically people extrapolating a belief. And in the absence of data, it's very easy for that to happen, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly what Verstappen did. You know, he has his incident, he's furious, and quite rightly he's furious, because not only has he lost the race, but, you know, his life's been put in danger by this random failure. And of course he gets out of the car and he kicks the left rear tyre that's deflated. And through his mind he's thinking, it's just these rubbish Pirellis again that have let me down. And it's his and his father Jos's intervention in preempting the outcome and saying, oh yeah, it's always the same, they'll just blame debris, oh look, what a surprise, that really, to your point, Mark, forces Pirelli's hand here. I don't think they can afford to gloss over or sweep away this as quickly as they might have done maybe in the past, because you've got the world championship leader basically calling them out before they've even done the investigation. So there's a lot more riding on this from a PR and narrative point of view than there would be normally. So I think they're going to have to... That's not to say they need to chase ghosts and try and find things that aren't there, but I agree with you that even though I don't think that I don't support the conspiracy theories, as I outlined before, I do agree with you. I think they need to show a little bit more clarity over their process and their investigation publicly, because the pressure is really on them based on what Verstappen has said, rightly or wrongly.
By the way, do either of you follow the Moving Bricks channel on YouTube, which replays every Grand Prix in Lego?
No.
Oh, this sounds like a must.
Okay, it is literally a must. And by the way, can I just declare, I have no interest in the channel. I have no financial interest. So it's just called the Moving Bricks channel on YouTube, and they replay every Grand Prix in Lego, and with Crofty doing the voiceover, so they take all of them. I mean, it is extraordinary. They just, how they do it, and they do it within...
They
like,
must love a race with crashes like they
well,
have in Baku.
So the best thing about the Azerbaijan replay is they have the little Lego figure of Max kick the rear tyre after the accident. And it's just a classic moment. So they've got each of their little Lego figurines done, and, you know, each of the driver's overalls. And I was actually watching it and thinking, I wonder if they're going to have the moment where Max kicks the rear wheel when he gets out of the car. And they do. They have it in Lego. I just think it's a beautiful a beautiful moment. I think it's... I mean, it's actually so well done. I think it's got to be... It's only a matter of time before Liberty buy the channel, because I think to children under 10 of all ages, including 59-year-olds like me, it's just a brilliant way. And it's actually a brilliant 10-minute recap of every Grand Prix, because they just show the key moments.
Do you know, I was quite disappointed that a tree branch didn't fall down so that Max could go the full Basil Fawlty on the back of the car and give it a good spanking.
give it a good thrashing.
He could have borrowed Charles Leclerc's tree branch if he'd had the foresight, I suppose.
This month we had the the sad duty of having to shuffle a few things round in the contents late doors to accommodate an obituary. It had to be done because Max was one of the giants of modern F1. He really shaped Formula One and the rest of motorsport in terms of safety as well. And he was a fascinating, very complex, polarizing individual. Personally, I respected his cleverness and his verbal dexterity, and obviously his work on safety. He pushed through a lot of measures, facing considerable pushback, both within motor racing and also with Euro NCAP. He had a lot of pushback from car manufacturers, but I found his capacity for cruelty and vindictiveness quite problematic. So yeah, an interesting character. So it was very interesting to write his obituary. Mark, in your column and on social media, you've been quite forthright in highlighting his work on safety and pouring cold water on the tabloid obsession with his sex life.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Whenever the News of the World Nazi sex orgy headline appeared, and there was so much controversy at that time, I remember writing a column for a website, and I said that I'd had a quick look at the rule book and that there was nothing to prevent the FIA president from having sex. And it certainly didn't say that he could only have sex with one person. And I got a note from Max to say, thank you, because you seem to have understood the key point, which is this is an invasion of privacy. I've only met Max a few times, and none of them were particularly great experiences, because as Andrew Benson, who is a regular Grand Prix Racing magazine contributor, wrote on his BBC obituary, and I refer to it in my column, he described Max as patrician and patronising, and I always found him incredibly patronising. I remember the first time I met him was at the RAC club when he was actually having a drink with someone, and I went over and introduced myself. And at the time, I was on the management board of Jordan, and I went over and I said, "Hi, Max. My name is Mark Gallagher. I work with Eddie Jordan." And it's hard to describe how he looked at me. I think he would have shown more interest in something that was on the pavement outside his house than wanting to talk to someone who worked for Eddie Jordan at that particular time. So it wasn't a particularly warm reception, if I can put it that way. And I was just being I was just being friendly, I just thought, be friendly. But anyway, but the fact of the matter is that I think what he did in terms of safety and then his privacy campaigning was extraordinary. And he had a lot of strengths, and yes, he had some weaknesses, no doubt about that. Highly political in his approach to things, and I talk about it in my column. The Bernie Max era was a difficult time for Formula One, because there was a divide and conquer mentality, and there were so many unhappy experiences. And I think it broke a lot of people. It broke a lot of companies that came into Formula One and wanted to do Formula One in a certain way. And I have to say, I think today, in 2021, when you look at the state of Formula One, you look at the degree of collaboration between Liberty and the FIA. Look at the fact that, we have a budget cap, that we have a new Concorde agreement, that, that the histrionics of the old days seem to have dissipated to some extent. This is all great. We're living in a much happier time for Formula One as an overall business than was the case under Bernie and Max. But nevertheless, Max contributed so much on the safety side, and it required a politician to go to Brussels, to go to the EU, and to effectively export the lessons that we had learned in Formula One after Imola 94 into the road car industry. And one of his big achievements was to get Louis Schweitzer, the chief executive of Renault Group, to recognize that if you got the safety of your cars right, you could use that for marketing. And it was a point that I talked to Max about on another occasion when he was a little bit more helpful. We got to talking about the fact that safety until Euro NCAP came along was a necessary evil. You know, car manufacturers fitted seatbelts because they had to. They did crash tests because they had to. And the crash tests were being done to incredibly low standards, which hadn't changed for, you know, well over 20 years, with cars getting much, much faster and road conditions changing and all the rest of it. And with Louis Schweitzer, they, you know, he was able to convince Renault that if you come out and say, we've crash tested the car that, you know, we will, that you can take your kids to school in every morning, and we've crash tested that car, and it's the safest car on the road. It will protect you, it'll protect your kids, it's got side impact protection, it's got airbags. All of a sudden, that became sexy. And of course, it's now taken for granted, because every car you look at, you know, they're all got the, they've got their five-star NCAP safety records. And I spent a couple of days with Volvo when I was running the Cosworth F1 project on a related topic to do with safety. And I spent 2 days with Volvo in Sweden at their safety sort of R&D facility, which is where they do crash tests. And Volvo told me that they said until Euro NCAP came along, you know, Volvos were simply the safest car to drive. And then what happened was, thanks to Euro NCAP, all the other manufacturers were dragged up to a much higher level of safety, which gave Volvo a problem, because they were no longer seen as being the safest car, you know, in the world. So they had to do something a little bit more. So that actually then caused Volvo to shift up a gear in terms of their safety, so that, you know, they said, we want a 7-star NCAP program, because we want to go from 5 stars to 6 stars to 7 stars. So there's a manufacturer saying that thanks to Euro NCAP, it brought the overall standard of the industry up to such a high level, and that can only have been a good thing. So Max did a huge amount of work on that. And then I think with the privacy campaigning, it's a topic that I, you know, feel strongly about, because there have been individuals in the, who would regard as sort of celebrities, who have been accused of things in the media which have subsequently been disproven, and but yet their reputations are ruined. And when you see people's reputations ruined by an unfounded allegation, that's not a good outcome. So I'm not saying that people should be protected, and you shouldn't, you know, from, if they've committed an offence. But if you haven't committed an offence, it's debatable that the media, for example, should be allowed to say, well, this person's been accused of, you know, whatever the crime happens to be, when actually there's literally no evidence to back that up. And I think that, I think Max has perhaps done more than anyone to move forward the privacy laws in this country, and to set some precedents. And, you know, for all that we're talking about the, some of the downsides in terms of Max's approach to things, he did a lot of good. And at least in the motorsport press, we've been able to talk about the positives that he brought in terms of safety, because in the mainstream media, the obituaries of Max were appalling. And I think the BBC 6 o'clock news didn't even mention his safety campaigning, literally only talked about his parents, talked about the scandal, talked about the privacy, never mentioned the facts. So actually the mainstream media had a problem with Max because of his privacy campaigning, and they didn't like him because he talked down to them. So at least in the motorsport media, we're able to give, I think there's been we've been able to give a little bit more balance to the contribution that Max made, and such an important figure in the sport. And then final thing I'll say on this is that when we go back and we look at Max's early career and the way he came into racing as a driver, and then helped to set up March Engineering, which went on to become such an important part of the landscape. You know, you consider Adrian Newey started his career in Formula One designing Leighton House March Formula One cars. You know, Max was at the epicenter of that whole era in motorsport history. So yeah, some of the later things that happened maybe clouded his reputation, but there's no question about it. Whatever else, he was very passionate about the sport throughout his career.
Certainly, one thing that we were taught, or what is drilled into us when we do these legal refresher courses, is that when you try and stake a claim for a public interest defence, public interest is not necessarily what interests the public. So you must never confuse those things. And Max very memorably took on the News of the World on that very issue, because his contention was that what he gets up to perfectly legally behind closed doors is none of the business of the readers of that particular newspaper. And he scored a memorable victory against Rupert Murdoch. And I think you can see the slightly the poisonous tone of the obits in the Murdoch newspapers show that victory still stings a little bit, because they, of course, played all those cliches, you know, the Nazi sex orgy, son of the fascist leader, etc., etc. But still, like you say, very, very, very fascinating man. But didn't always win everything, did he? Because he tried to get the budget cap through and failed at that time. But now we have it, and probably better realised. The detail seems to be a little bit more full, a bit better worked out than back in 2008, 2009, where Max sort of tried to force through the unified powertrain, which not many people were happy with, but the incoming teams were. And then you ended up with a situation where we had, what, 3-4 new teams come in on the promise that they'd be able to compete for $50 million or £50 million a year. And that never happened, because Max was already sort of gone and off to pick up his legal case against the newspapers. And Jean Todt, I got the impression, never really believed in the budget cap and let it die quietly, and the opportunity was lost. But here we are again, and it just seems a little bit better worked out this time. And Mark, you've actually spoken to some bean counters at major Formula One teams and found out how they're actually going to do it. And because the introductory sentence in your piece was so powerful that our art editor put it in giant sort of 84-point lettering, which is, in case you haven't noticed, Mercedes is counting the pennies. And it's amazing that Formula One's richest team is now having to sort of pat down its pockets and watch what it spends. And the Valtteri Bottas crash at Imola really could have put that team behind, not just this year, but for next year as well in terms of development.
I enjoyed writing this feature because I got so much support from Mercedes-Benz and Ferrari in particular, and maybe that in itself tells a story, because essentially the teams with the very largest budgets in Formula One really wanted to talk about the impact of the budget cap, because they're having to come down to it. Let's be absolutely clear, the top teams are having to come down to that $145 million per year budget cap. The smaller teams, frankly, most of the rest of the field don't need to worry about it, because they've never had that kind of money to spend in the first place. But certainly the larger teams are having to come down. And what was really striking was that in speaking to both those teams in particular at length, I came away with a real sense of their determination to meet those caps. And that they've put in place a very rigorous system, because they know they're going to be scrutinised by the FIA, and there is essentially a cost cap commission which has the power to come in and have a look at your books. And you twice a year you have to file a set of accounts as to how the money is being spent. And this is the budget cap, to be clear, applies to the design, development and operation of the Formula One cars. And in the feature, I talk at some length about what's not included in the budget cap. And I've done that intentionally, because there has been a tendency to say, oh, well, the budget cap doesn't include a couple of things like the driver's salaries and the top three salaries of the top executives in the team. Actually, there's an incredibly long list of things. You know, marketing is not included in it. Finance is not included in it. HR is not included in it. Property development, you know, lots of other costs which are actually excluded. So in many parts and many departments, it's kind of almost business as usual. On the technical side of the team, however, it's a profound shift. And to your point, I mean, the reason I started with, you know, Mercedes are counting the pennies, was that in the wake of the Imola accident, Andy Shovlin had admitted that this could have a potential impact on their development. And as we know, then subsequently Mercedes-Benz pulled out of a Pirelli wet weather tire test, citing the fact that they couldn't afford to do it. Afford in the sense not that they don't have money, but they couldn't afford to do it because in order to run that Pirelli wet weather tire test, they would have had to have sent staff from England who are not in the race team. And the moment staff are repurposed across from non-cost cap activities to cost cap activities, you suddenly have to include them in that cost cap calculation. So there's implications there also on the use of powertrain. Cost. So you have a fixed amount of mileage, 5,000 kilometers that you're allowed, per unit. And again, if you do a test, you potentially go over that. So there's, or you run the risk of exceeding that limit. So there's a lot of complexity to this. If we zoom out completely and we sort of take a helicopter view of it, my takeaways were that, first of all, in exactly the same way as Adrian Newey and James Allison sit down and look at the technical regulations and say, how do I explore the limits of these? The teams are now doing the same on the financial regulations. But that's not to say they're looking for loopholes to spend more money. They're not. What they're looking to do is they're looking to make sure that every dollar they spend is spent wisely. And I found it really interesting with Ferrari. Ferrari actually were saying, this is exciting because this is forcing us to design and manufacture and operate Formula One cars on an efficiency formula. And it's a financial efficiency formula. And in the same way that we have an energy efficiency formula where you are of a given amount of fuel and you have to make that car, operate with that given amount of fuel and fuel flow, actually the same applies. It's a financial flow and we are limited on that. And actually they relish it. They see it as a challenge. And of course, the nitty gritty of how they're doing it, I go into in the piece. But essentially, you've got these parallel accounting practices. What's in the budget cap? What's not in the budget cap? You have to be recording all of that in quite some detail. The cost cap commission can look for that at any point in time. The penalties for breaching it are potentially very significant. If you go over the budget cap just a little bit, like within 5% in any one area, you can basically plead a kind of a mistake and you can get a slap on the wrists. You might lose some points. For example, if they felt that there was a penalty to be applied as a result of it going before the adjudication committee. If someone decides to breach the budget cap in a really underhand way, if someone decides to cook the books effectively in terms of the budget cap, the penalties are potentially very extreme. You could be banned from the World Championship. And the thing that I found really interesting, a really, really kind of focusing moment in reading through all of that and then talking to the teams, is that the senior executives in the teams are personally liable. So if you're the chief financial officer, if you're the chief technology officer, if you're the chief executive and the team principal, you are actually named in the regulations. It is down to you to absolutely make sure that your team is on the right side of those cost cap regulations. And if you've been a director of a company and you have fiduciary duties, you don't want to be struck off. You don't want to be declared as someone who has overstepped the line and such. And potentially, again, the implication of someone being, maliciously and in a premeditated way, blowing the budget cap by somehow trying to park costs in another part of the company and all that kind of smoke and mirrors routine, is that you could be personally banned from the sport as well. So it's a really interesting area to get into. It's hard, difficult to watch Formula One and imagine that this financial cost cap is somehow having a material impact, but it is very much having a material impact. And so for both Ferrari and Mercedes, it has meant pulling right back on how they spent money. In Mercedes-Benz's case, they've given me a figure, which is they've cut back about £50 million. So that's about $70 million of operational cost. That is not a small amount of money. The interesting thing is then that a lot of people said, well, with the cost cap, Ferrari are going to have to do the Indy 500 because they're going to have so many people who won't be able to work in Formula One. So they'll have to go and do Le Mans. They'll have to go and do the Indy 500 and do all these other things. Actually, what's happened is the teams have worked incredibly hard to safeguard jobs. So Mercedes-Benz have been through a process where they've lost about 50 people from the company. So that's not anything like the tidal wave of redundancies that some were forecasting when the budget cap was announced. Ferrari's approach has been to redeploy people into their road car division. And Ferrari's point was, if we have smart people working for us and we can no longer deploy them within the budget cap in Formula One, we'll keep them in the group because that know-how doesn't get lost within the group. So actually the teams have taken a very interesting approach. And then in Red Bull's case, rather associated with Honda's withdrawal from Formula One, but
set up a new business.
They've set up a new business. Exactly. They've set up Red Bull Powertrains. But actually, you know, it's a very elegant solution for them because they needed to fix the Honda problem when Honda announced their withdrawal. And the budget cap means that, you know, they've got a fixed amount of money that is allocated now for in terms of engine costs, 15 million euros per team. So that's for a two team package, which is what they essentially have. They have got straight away 30 million euros, and that's very specifically for the engine supply and doesn't include lots of other things which they can then go and spend more money on. So actually the Red Bull powertrain solution is an incredibly elegant solution in terms of playing to some of the options available under the budget cap. It also profoundly strengthens the team because the lack of powertrain supply, the fact that they've been competing against Mercedes and Ferrari, who have everything in, you know, in-house, had become a weak link for Red Bull, and that's not going to be the case. So actually my read on the whole situation looking at the budget cap is that it's having the impact that was required. It's been a painful process for the big teams, but they've worked incredibly hard to safeguard jobs and then to come up with very elegant ways of making sure that they can continue to deliver. But one thing is for sure as a result of all of this is that the days of Formula One having, you know, bottomless pits of money to spend and, you know, no one counting the pennies, those days are gone. Everyone is now counting exactly how they spend their money. And actually, they're quite relishing the efficiencies that is driving into their operations in terms of how they design, manufacture, and develop the cars. And I think that it can only be a good thing. So it's an environment of financial scarcity in relative terms for the big teams. And it is leading to those teams now having the prospect of being properly profitable and being able to sustain their business as a profitable business in a way that we haven't really seen in Formula One history before. So it's strengthened the sport, and it's going to be interesting to see how it develops further over the next couple of years as the cap comes down to 140 and 135 in the years ahead.
Who knows? We might soon or one day no longer be able to say that the fastest way to make a small fortune in motor racing is to start off with a large one.
Well, you know, I mean, all jokes aside, that's got to be a good thing, isn't it? Because for someone like, for example, Lawrence Stroll, who's come into Formula One just now with Aston Martin. I mean, Lawrence Stroll, despite, you know, again, you know, what conspiracy theorists and social media commentators might say about Lawrence. I mean, he's a serious businessman, and he wants to have a very profitable car company called Aston Martin. He wants to have a very profitable Formula One team, and this cost cap helps all the teams on the road to achieving that. And you know, if you look at Alpine again, I mean, when I wrote the feature in the magazine earlier this year about Alpine's arrival in Formula One. The only way that Alpine and Renault are going to stay in Formula One through the next big regulation change in 2025 is if their Formula One team is profitable. And if their Formula One team is not profitable and not competitive, they will pull out, no question about it. So I think this is helping everyone to build a sustainable business. And that can only be good for Formula One, and hopefully will help attract others to come into the sport as well, because and I remain hopeful that we will see a Volkswagen Audi group brand come into the sport, possibly see Porsche come into the sport at some point for the new powertrain regulations when they emerge. And I think all of this helps towards that, because the sport has gone from a slightly corrupt-looking sport, you know, during the Eccleston-Mosley days. You know, you think about the bribery scandal in Germany, which overshadowed, you know, so much of Eccleston's final decade in control of the sport. You think about the manufacturer breakaway series that was threatened in 2009 and all the politics around that. All that messiness has been taken off the table, and the financial governance of the sport has now been tidied up thanks to this budget cap. And I think for anyone sitting in a boardroom in a car manufacturer or major sponsor, whatever, around the world, that's only got to be a good thing, because Formula One suddenly looks like it's really cleaned its act up in a pretty compelling way. And it's measurable. That's the other thing. It's a financially measurable way of achieving it. So it's been interesting.
Yeah, without trying to get carried away, it does feel like Formula One is on the right track and heading towards a good place. Look, the budget cap side of it is one element where you feel like so many people are looking from the outside going, well, it just costs an exorbitant sum to be competitive, so why would I even bother? Whereas now it feels like the pandemic plus the Concorde Agreement and the budget cap has forced the big spenders to come back, rein it all in, and now it seems achievable for more people, and that should be enough to stimulate more interest from those who perhaps are sitting on the sidelines wishing it were different. And then also on the on-track side, you've got the tweaks to the regulations of this year, which were designed as a kind of flavour of the revolution that was paused until 2022, with cuts to the floor and the hope that cars could follow better and there would be closer racing and more teams being more competitive. And not everything has come together yet, obviously, but they have achieved that to some degree this year. You've got, you know, Mercedes have been pegged back. Red Bull have become more competitive relative to them, obviously, but also the rest of the field is closer, or it feels like it's getting closer. Maybe not every team, but certainly more teams. And suddenly you've got McLaren closer to the pace and Ferrari closer to the pace again. And the whole thing just feels like it's coming good. And if the 2022 rules can build on some of these elements that have been so effective from one year to the next, then actually you could have a really compelling sport, both on track and off track.
Now, I have to burst your bubble there, Ben, because one of the things which I was told by one of the teams, and I can't mention which.
Are you going to ruin my day?
That they're forecasting huge disappointment in 2022, because the point they were making is that this year is beautiful, because this year the regulations are not only mature, like really mature, but they've been carried over. We're in an unusual year where the large teams have been absolutely, they're on to the 2022 car. So they're essentially running a 2020 car this year, albeit with some, you know, some upgrades. But it's for example, they're the same monocoques as last season. And, you know, their point to me was that whilst everyone can't wait for 2022, because apparently it's all going to be a level playing field, it's going to be fantastic, their view was that the cars are actually not going to be that impressive, and that inevitably there will be consequences from the big change. And the consequences generally of big changes like this tend to be that the top teams move away again. They actually make another step forward. But will
the unique conditions change that? That has been historically the case, but we're going through a unique period where you've got the global pandemic causing massive waves through how teams operate, plus the cost cap, plus everything else in terms of big regulation change, plus managing this year's championship battle. So I suppose the hope is that this is the one that breaks the cycle.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I hope they're wrong. I was disappointed. They volunteered that. I didn't ask them. I was a volunteer.
That's sad news.
That was like, yeah. God, really? And they were like, it's going to go bad to the old hierarchical pecking order. And
they should carry the same cars over for another year then. Just abandon the 2022 revolution.
But I mean, we all know that as regulations continue, you know, as they mature, there is a balance is achieved, because the people who've taken some time to catch up finally learn, you know, what everyone else has been doing, and it converges. There's a convergence that happens as regulations mature. We saw that during the V8 era, and you know, we've seen it now during the hybrid era as well. But anyway, let's hope that Ross and the folks at the FIA and Pat and everyone has gotten their figures right, and that we end up with level pegging. Because again, going back to Azerbaijan, you know, when you see the Perez, Vettel, Gasly podium, you know, we would love to have more unpredictable outcomes, and we would particularly like to see more teams in with a chance. Because again, going back and mentioning Alpine and Renault, you know, there's a team that needs to make a breakthrough. They need to get onto the podium, and they need the prospect of victory over the next 3 years or so. And again, having watched Luca Di Meo's, you know, State of the Nation online address back in January, a three-hour presentation from Renault Group headquarters, they really need the Formula One project to be successful. And the profitability aspect that could be brought about as a result of the budget cap is one thing, but they actually also need to have a modicum of success on the track. And if that doesn't happen under these 2022 regulations, which everyone has so much hope for,
including Alonso, of course, who's
and including
all
Alonso.
Of his faith on the basis
that
the regulations are going to bring the championship back towards
absolutely
Alpine.
And you know, and but it applies to everyone. And I think, you know, again, like McLaren, you mentioned McLaren, we've seen an upward trajectory for them. Fantastic job being done by Lando Norris in particular, and you know, and Andrea Seidel wants to continue that upwards trajectory. Now, what does that mean? So that upwards, to be clear, that upwards trajectory for McLaren means that despite the fact that they're running a customer engine, they want to win races, and they have an expectation of being able to win races. And if something happens as a result of these 2022 rules that prevents that, if McLaren plateau at fourth place in the championship for the coming years, that's not their ambition. You know, their ambition is to win races and to have a chance of going for the championship. And that's so, yeah, there's a lot of ifs in there, but let's see if my friend at one of the big teams can be proven wrong, and hopefully we have a close championship.
Anyhow, we've gone well over our hour, and poor old producer Martin is going to end up having to wield the scissors if we carry on rattling on. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. It's been a fascinating broadcast as ever. Always great to chew over the contents of the latest GP racing with some of the key stakeholders, as we have to call such people nowadays. And so Mark, you've been very on brand with your Goodyear T-shirt today, but it seems to have some pistons on it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's an official Goodyear product, which someone sent to me. But for some reason, I've never bought a Goodyear piston. Did they ever make a piston?
I should point out that Mark Gallagher doesn't have any financial interest in
Goodyear. other tires are available.
We'll be back next month. Mark Gallagher, thank you very much for your sagacious wisdom.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Ben, thank you for continuing to keep me in employment and for coming with great ideas like Let's Do a Podcast.
You're welcome.
What marvellous. We will be back next month. Don't forget that the latest issue of GP Racing is now available on the newsstands. Go to gpracing.com for a marvellous range of subscription offers. And don't forget, there are many other podcasts available from the Motorsport Network empire. Just browse through our selection, like and subscribe. I won't say smash that like button. Oh dear, I just did. Thank you. We'll see you next month.